It's hi, it's Matt.
And Hillary.
It's Marooned on Mars with Matt and Hillary.
That's right. It is the podcast where we are reading Kim Stanley Robinson novels. And in this case, we are on Blue Mars.
Mm-hmm.
We are on section 8 of Blue Mars, the green and the white.
The green and the white. And we're both wearing blackface, and we're going to resign and be replaced by Republicans next week. So this is the farewell... Where I was just listening to Democracy Now! From yesterday. It's all about the Virginia governor's...
What a fucked up story. What is those people?
It's just amazing. A single politician out of the South white politician from the South has ever...
Not worn blackface.
I think that's probably true.
I felt like in the initial coverage of the governor, I mean, obviously there was a lot of like hilarious, I mean, not, oh, man. In truth,
he
not
almost
funny.
He almost moonwalked.
I heard a couple of things that made it sound like, well, it was the 80s. And yeah. I just felt like, are you fucking kidding me? It's not like blackface was okay in the 80s. Blackface wasn't ever okay. And it was perfectly possible to know that, you know? And certainly like post, like, I don't know, like 1925 or something, right?
They were on Democracy Now! They were playing a clip from a movie called In the Army Now, which had like Ronald Reagan was like hosting it. He was like the host. And he introduced a white performer in blackface. This is from 1943. It was in a movie called In the Army Now.
Oh my God.
He introduces a blackface performer. I mean, we got problems as a society.
Seriously. Oh my God. Oh, it is just how fucking vile. I mean, you know, and it's another argument for the guillotine. Come on.
Definitely.
It's a good solution.
For sure. It's really hard when I'm teaching my students, and especially about Marxism, not to just bring up the guillotine all the time.
I mean, Marx was not a fan of the guillotine.
Oh, that's good to know. But he was a fan of class war. And this chapter, The Green and the White, doesn't have much class war in it.
No, and it doesn't have any blackface in it.
No blackface, thank God. But it's an excellent, amazing chapter. I really enjoyed reading this chapter.
Me too. And I was going to say, I mean, we don't actually need to like get into this because I don't think you've read Aurora.
I haven't read Aurora.
But I'm teaching Aurora now.
Right.
I won't get into this because I really want you to read that so that we can talk about it. And I don't want to spoil anything.
Well, that'll be like a year from now.
But there are some... you have a good memory.
Okay.
But there are some like interesting echoes in here with Aurora. And also, it is so fun to teach it. And I realized I was like a little bit nervous on the first day because I really, really love that book. Mm-hmm. And I've actually never taught a Robinson novel before because I mostly teach stuff written by women.
Right.
But I taught The Dispossessed, and then Aurora follows so like amazingly from The Dispossessed, and the students' conversations were like, anyway, whatever, the conversations have already been really interesting.
Cool.
But so I was reading for class yesterday because my schedule is very tightly packed. So I really only have time to prep for class before class. So mm-hmm. I just get to campus as early as I can in the morning, and then I teach in the early afternoon, and I just try to spend the like 5 hours or whatever I have just like intensively prepping. And I wanted to reread a big stretch of Aurora. I mean, I always like to read right before class, obviously. And in the like probably 150 pages that I was reading for class yesterday, I cried crying three different times.
You're a very good reader.
That book is so sad. Oh my God. And I just forgot there are a couple of things in just the first parts of it that are so devastatingly sad. And then I thought like, oh, and all my students are sad because it's like winter and it's so cold, and at University of Chicago is on the quarter system, so those are 10 week, you have 10 week 10 weeks of class, 1 week of finals.
Yeah.
And so winter, when it's going to be like extremely cold, and although it's getting lighter every day, it still feels pretty dark. And the students all take like extra classes in the winter. So anyway, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone, but whatever.
It's
Aurora,
the most stressful time at the University of Chicago.
It's extremely stressful.
It's the very middle of the quarter where it's like the stress is just really starting to mount, and it will just build and build and build for the next 4 weeks.
Yes. Like it's the time when like in weeks, like week four of the quarter, I have students both talking to me about their midterms and their final papers, like at the same time, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
Whatever. Aurora is awesome. So just saying that. So, really love the book. Excited to be teaching it.
Okay. So lots of overlap between this chapter and Aurora.
Some interesting echoes.
Echoes.
Some interesting echoes.
This one's a Nergal chapter, and it starts with this amazing prologue of how Earth is kind of coping with the opening up of Mars as a kind of escape valve for immigration, right? Escape valve for the Malthusian problem that Earth is facing. And I actually mentioned this last week, the conclusion that William Fort and the Praxis people come to is that it's really just a psychological outlet,
because
they go through the numbers of what it would be. And it's like, well, India is planning on going at full capacity for a couple of centuries and then just seeing taking stock again of where they're at, right? So it's just this thing that, you know, they can send 10 million a year. Mars has only said that it would accept 1 million a year. But even 10 million a year off of Earth with 17 or 18 billion people is just nothing.
Right, is nothing. Yeah, it's interesting to think that this sort of, I mean, we've talked about population before. And I think, as I've said before, I think it's impossible to talk about, you know, it's impossible for sort of like discussions of population not to bear with them like a bunch of racist, colonialist, and class-based baggage, right? Mm-hmm. But one of the things that's interesting about this is this idea that it would help to have like a relief valve, right? You know, for people to imagine that there's something else, which I think already tells you, like, it's not really, like, the pure math problem that people like to pretend that it is, right? It's also about, like, there's that moment later on in the chapter where Jackie is saying something about immigration, and Nergal's like, I mean, we're talking about a billion people. A billion is not a number a person can imagine, which is actually one of the things that made me think of Aurora, because there's a bunch of stuff early on where one of the main characters is kind of, like an ark ship, basically. And one of the main characters is going from like little biome to biome in the ark ship. And she feels like in each place that she gets to, like she meets basically everybody there. And the sort of comment that the narrator makes is that this is like the fallacy of ease of representation, because in fact, like most of the time when you feel like you've actually met everybody in a situation, like the maximum number of people you might actually know is like 50 or something like that.
Right,
it's like quite a small number.
Right.
But all the time we tell ourselves like, well, I think I know what people are thinking, or like I know most of the people in my block or at my school or whatever it is. And that idea of like, how do you deal with human problems when the scale of them is such that it's not only like, of course you couldn't know a billion people or a million people or what, you know, like you could only know the teeniest tiny fraction of them, and yet it remains a human problem, right? Yeah. You know, that, when you can't even hold in your head, like what a billion means.
Yeah. It's a problem of scale. And it's a problem, especially in like huge and enormously complex societies like ours and like the one represented in the books. It made me think too about in terms of that like safety valve concept, it's useful that for me it was interesting that we're reading this chapter the same week that the Green New Deal is announced by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Markey or whoever that is, and like the immediate like response is like from the right is, it's impractical, it'll never happen, even if we wanted it to, which we don't want it to.
Right.
Who's going to pay for it? Where will the money come from? All the negative things. Completely missing out on the fact that it really, the numbers don't matter. The numbers are things you have to deal with when you have to deal with them. But the point about it but has people riled up and interested about it is the idea of it. Like, it's an enormous big project that we can all work toward. That's what's exciting about it. That's what's necessary and urgent about it,
right,
is that it's still an idea, and that it will motivate a whole kind of range, a different way of thinking about the world, like a different orientedness toward the future.
Right. Or even like a different orientedness toward the present. Because
yeah,
I think
for
that's
sure.
part of what like, that I, you know, the idea of like making a very short time frame is not only because like that's necessary,
right?
Because like, you know, we're so severely behind. It's also like the tightness of the time frame means that, I mean, to me, this is the idea. I don't know whether this is a thing that the Green New Deal planners thought about, but the tightness of the time frame means that the story can't be, we have to do this for our children or the next generation or some future moment or like, whatever, you know, I won't live to see it, but blah,
my grandparents,
blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Right. You know, like saying like, actually like this has to happen like now, right now, this is ongoing. This is what we're living in, which is the same thought about like, you know, that idea that there's not money for it,
right?
Like, of course there's money for
it. Yeah. Modern monetary theory aside, where we can print as much money as we want,
I recommend we take the money from Howard Schultz.
Yeah. Take it from Howard Schultz.
Jeff Bezos.
Take it from Jeff Bezos. And take it from the oil companies and the insurance industry. Like,
they
do have a real plan. That, you know, going back to what you were saying, though, it's not for the future. It's for us. It's for right now. And like, we have these massive industries that need to be abolished anyway. To just retool them toward a Green New Deal would seem to be well within human capacity. Like, what do people who work for insurance companies do? They just push paper around. What do you need? You know, like, you need a lot of organization to make a Green New Deal. You need to like abolish the oil industry. Those people work with their hands and like make all kinds of cool things with machines. That's what you need to do with the Green New Deal, right? Like, seems like pretty obvious shit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, not whatever. It's good. It's good. It's good that somebody's like doing something and saying like, it's time to like,
I'm glad they're doing it, not us. Cause it gives us time to talk about these books.
Well, thank God. And also, I mean, I feel like this is another chapter, like after that Nadia chapter, that kind of reminds you, like, once politics is in place, right? Like, once the structures of government are in place, once you have that stuff done, like, man, you really move out of like the mode of the utopian and into the grind of the, you know, the bureaucratic and the Machiavellian, like,
immediately.
Like, the threat of that is like so present. I just want to say one more thing from the introduction, because I do like this moment on 349. You know, Amy is feeling despairing, and she's like, besides, since when have treaties ever stopped governments from doing what they wanted to do?
Mm-hmm.
William Fort said, we'll have to send them somewhere else. The others looked at him. Where? Said Amy. No one replied. Fort waved a hand vaguely. But, you know, right. So right there, I guess we get our sort of like first moment of beginning to think about like what it would be to stretch out into the solar system more generally. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But just Fort being like, let's send them someplace else.
Yeah. What about somewhere else?
Make no little plans.
Running the cup. The Indians running their program at capacity for a couple of centuries and then seeing where they stand. This first paragraph of the chapter proper is very reminiscent of the way that Fred Fredericks and the poet guy land on the moon in Red Mars, like the descent rapidly and then slowly, right? I guess it's probably just a, you know, convention of how you land on a planet anyway, but it reminded me of Red Moon. And this opening up here kind of feeds it out from the psychological safety valve thing into the magical thinking of immortality and the fear of illness, right?
Yeah.
The longevity treatment, because Nergal saw suddenly that for many people, the longevity treatments equaled immortality. They did not want to think otherwise. They looked away because he's the one who almost died, right?
Right.
And death is so rare and illness is so rare that this will be a chapter about kind of ideas and I mean, it's a book about ideas and the limits of ideas and things like that.
Yeah.
Like their possibility.
And that he sees himself as being stigmatized, you know, like he's become like unhealthy. I mean, and so that's, I think that's, which, and then, so we also learn in the chapter that, like, the rumor is that Jackie, who still looks, you know, 15 Mars years old, started taking the treatments at age 10, which is wild, and that Nergal has not had the treatments yet, right?
Or yeah, has he not had them at all?
I think he says that. He thinks at some point, like, I should probably do that. But it's also interesting to think that so on the one hand, like, people's life experiences are really different because their lives are so extended, and that just means the horizon of death is just farther away, and ill health is also rarer, right? But then it also feels clear here that, like, that's kind of turned into, since they look at Nergal and, like, you know, have this response to him, like, there's something wrong with you, health then becomes, you know, it's like turned into, like, something that's like a value, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like, therefore, if you get ill, there must be something wrong with you, like, not necessarily bodily, but maybe, like, you know, a moral infirmity, or you're, like, gross in some fundamental way, you know, like, so there's this, like, just slidiness for people between, like, bodily experience and, like, the sort of, like, metaphorizing or analogizing of the body experience to, like, I'm healthy because I'm good, which is, I mean, certainly a characteristic of the biopolitical moment we live in, where you're supposed to, you know, you're exercising and you're, like, eating whatever
kale.
You're, or like, you know, probiotics. Your keto diet or whatever, you know, is like, anyway, so I mean, I think that that's just, like, that's an interesting thing to come back to. And it's interesting for him, you know, the charismatic, I mean, the whole chapter in some ways is about him experiencing and re-experiencing that, despite the fact that he is native to Mars, indigenous to Mars, born on Mars, like, that is actually it's a process of becoming or emergence. It's not it is not, like, a given, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he repeatedly re-experiences not just alienation and estrangement, but the feeling of, like, you know, one is not born indigenous to the place, one becomes it in some kind of way, right? And that you can be jarred out of that, or you can be refused it.
Well, like, later in the chapter, he will say, well, I guess we're indigenous now, once he kind of, like, really lays down roots in that one moment, in that one
spot. Literal roots.
Literal roots.
Right, plant roots.
But there's a double kind of disconnect here, because he has been gone for at least a year, because it's gone all the way to Earth and then back, which the trip alone is like a year. So however much time he spent on Earth, right? And so although a year is a short time, in revolutionary time, it's really fast.
True,
all these new structures have come into place, and especially Jackie has really consolidated all this power around her, even though, you know, as just a member of the executive council, she supposedly has no power. It becomes very clear that she's got a lot of power. In fact, she has servants, right? Which is so, just to, like, help her. You know, she's got this kid with no father, which Nergal has a problem with, but she also has servants to help take care of the kid and to, like, summon different people and to make certain calls and to all this kind of,
stuff, it's like, she has a bunch of, she has, like, a nanny and, like, executive assistants or something.
And she, it's on 354, 355, she, like, brings sort of Nergal over to the side while she breastfeeds, right? She does, like, you know, the motherly thing. Mm-hmm. And, like, you know, of course, it's, like, sexual and stuff like this for Nergal and stuff. She has this long history. And then she feeds the kid. Her child pulled away, and Jackie tucked her breast in her bra and let down her shirt. Marie, she called, and her assistant entered. I think her diaper needs changing, right? Like, the worst kind of Ivanka Trump kind of move. Like, I did the, you know, glory, the pretty thing. Now you do you take care of the shit.
You take care of the shit.
And Nergal, servants now, you know. Jackie's mouth went tight again, and she stood calling, Mem, we're going to have to meet with those environmental court people about this Chinese request, you know. So, and then Nergal, you just make the decisions. And then Jackie dismissed him with a wave of the hand. Nice to have you back, Nergal, but try to catch up. All right.
Yeah. I mean, the picture of Jackie in this chapter is just, like, deeply unsympathetic, which I guess we can assume is to some extent coming from Nergal.
Obviously. But also.
Although she at the same time seems like pretty unsympathetic.
Yeah.
But we have this interesting on 356. I mean, obviously, I have some thoughts about like Nergal being bothered that the child doesn't know that it, you know, who its father is. But on 356, he's thinking about like, how is it that she has power, right? Because her, that position on the executive council is not a powerful position. Although we saw in the last chapter with Nadia that these are like, in some ways they are powerful positions, like depending on what you think power is or how power gets wielded, right? But so on 356, he's thinking about like, he's back. Ketchup, Free Mars was now a political party, the biggest on Mars. It had not always been that way. It had begun as something more like a network of friends or the part of the underground that lived in the demimonde, mostly students of the university, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, a kind of vague umbrella term for those sympathetic to the underground, but not followers of some more specific political movement or philosophy, which I think is interesting. I mean, like part of what I think is interesting here is this kind of like the way in which Free Mars was like actually really not a particularly ideologically anchored party, the Democratic Party, you know, so in many ways it had been Nergal's creation,
right?
And, you know, and in this chapter we see him also as a person who is unanchored in some ways, right? Is concerned about that problem with being anchored. Nergal had traveled around the planet, stayed with people who organized meetings, and this had gone on for so long that eventually people wanted a name. People wanted names for things. Mm-hmm. And so Free Mars. And in the revolution, it had become a rallying point for the natives, rising up out of society as a kind of emergent phenomenon, with many more people declaring themselves members than one would have guessed possible. Millions, the native majority, the very definition of the revolution. In fact, the main reason for its success, Free Mars as a sentence, an imperative, and they had done it. Mm-hmm. But then now it has become a party. Free Mars had gone from a movement to an organization. That was fine. It was the normal course of events. No one could complain about it. But it also has been then left open to all of the problems of party politics, right? But I think that so we get later in the chapter when he's planting stuff, we think about like, and he has the problem with the little virons that are killing his crops, right? That
virids.
We learn that is about like, that's like an emergence problem, right? And here we have that idea that like, something that felt like this natural phenomenon that just like rose up out of like and was signed on to by all the people who thought of themselves as natives ends up like being a kind of like placeholder that can just get filled with actually a really familiar kind of power.
Well, later, like, you know, after the moment, it's funny. This is interesting because he discovers, they discover the parasite after Jackie's visit, right? Yeah. And that's when he tells Jackie that she's not interested in Mars. She's interested in power. Or he doesn't tell her that because she wouldn't understand.
Yeah.
And so, just power takes that form. And it's really great to think about Nergal's anxiety around paternity in relation to his anxiety around what Free Mars has become, right? He's the father. It had been Nergal's creation. Okay, right, so he's not the father of it, but he's the father of Free Mars. He might be the father of Jackie's baby. He has anxiety about Jackie's baby not having a father. And he has his own anxiety about his own rootlessness, right? Like, Hiroko was not a really great mother when you come to think of it, like in terms of like your traditional idea of what a mother's supposed to be. Coyote, who he encounters on a park bench, who is his actual father, is also like a very weird sort of person to bond paternalistically toward. And Nergal also in general has like, you know, if his anxiety about Jackie's kid not having a father is sort of reflective of his own anxiety about not having a kind of father or rootedness, he also, this chapter is also about how he has sort of too many parental figures. Like all of the people, all of the other characters that we were introduced to in Red Mars are in some way a parent to Nergal in a certain sense, right? Like even John Boone, who he never met, has this kind of, he has inherited a lot from John Boone, but growing up in the kind of that zygote kind of collective, you know, Nadia was kind of a parent, and she and Art now are literally our parents. They have a child now. Maya, Sachs, the list goes on and on about how many different people Nergal kind of has anxiety about sort of pleasing or reflecting their values or mediating their own sort of, mediating their expectations of him or whatever.
I think that's really interesting. And of course, this is another chapter where he's like looking for Hiroko, mm-hmm. Because he thinks that finding Hiroko is going to give him some kind of answer. But I was just thinking when you were saying that, so the sort of, the thing that he says to Jackie is like, do you think it's okay for a child not to have a father? I mean, he's actually like specific that, right? And then, he's like single parent, like being brought up with a single parent or whatever. And she's like, well, on Mars, we don't really have the biological family in the same way. And he's like, no, there are people who have families, right? But, this is the one place where I feel like, I think Jackie is actually like right. Like mm-hmm. there are lots of different ways of doing this. But we could think like, so one version of the problem that he's facing is this kind of like, is this problem of like parentage as like, or like lineage, right? So in that way, he is supposed to be like the first native generation, but also the generation, and he's supposed to be their representative, right. Their charismatic representative, but he's also supposed to be the generation that has inherited right. from the first 100,
right.
right? And him in particular, right? With his, his particular relationship to Hiroko, his kind of whatever, his sort of stature in that way. So there's one version of it in which he is like haunted by these kind of like figures of the generation of the first 100. But I was also thinking, I think that you can think about the kind of, and that's a version of that problem of like what happens with Free Mars, when you create it and then like how do you know what happens with it, right? This kind of problem, but being native. But I think there's another way to think about that, which is like, it's not only, you could actually read, rather than reading like the members of the first 100 who he thinks about as like sort of stand-in parental figures, we could also think about that like as a different kind of like, network or a different kind of kinship structure, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. In which like, well, but actually like, he's had like support of one kind from Nadia, mm-hmm. And has supported her
right.
and, support of another kind from Sachs. Right. And he, his like, whatever kind of like, however much Hiroko clearly is not like the version of a mother that like, could appear on a like, television show or whatever, like
Leave It to Beaver.
Also like she seems to have like participated in like the growing up of a bunch of like amazing people, right? So the right. other thing is this kind of like, but actually there's this network all over the place that he's part of, and like that part is like more like the roots of the plants,
yeah,
and, like how you get things to grow, right?
Yeah. But that doesn't but he has trouble like realizing that, like it is another problem
right.
of misrecognition of or of inability to recognize who he is and where he fits in with all of this, right? Because Jackie has figured it out. She's very confident in who she is.
I mean, I don't think she's figured that thing out.
Well, at least she maybe...
I don't think she feels like she's part of, like, an extended kinship network. I think she feels like she's part of, like, she is a unique inheritor.
That's kind of what I meant. Like,
right.
I mean, maybe it's not what I meant, but it's not a problem. It's not a problem for her
right.
in the way
right.
that it is for Nergal. And that has whatever it has to do with his relationship both to Hiroko and to Coyote, who like took him away from the town when he was like whatever 10 years old and like drove all around Mars and like left that huge impression on him where
right.
he can never feel at home anywhere, right?
I mean, I think that like that's why he has to like get to the place here where he decides he's gonna, as he says, be an eco-poet,
yeah.
but like spend this time like trying to make stuff grow and trying to understand mm-hmm. like the land and the planet in a different way, because he's not getting there. I mean, we've seen the way that like he thinks as a child, like he needs to get to that moment where he can have the kind of like intuitive apprehension of something, right? That's the green and the,
mm-hmm.
his moment of understanding the green and the white is mm-hmm. through like this like natural observation that allows him to then, have a kind of conceptual understanding of something
right.
that's so important to him. And I think this chapter does that for him too, except that it's also still not clear like where is he going? You know, and some of this is, I guess, the burden of the person who's supposed to have a role.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. He's supposed to know and he doesn't. And people look to him for kind of knowledge that he doesn't have or doesn't know that he has. And they often get things out of him that, or they like are inspired in some way by him or respond to him in certain ways. Like when they're sitting around the campfire and this one woman says, oh, I saw Hiroko, but she doesn't know who Nagal is. And when she finds out who he is, she acts weird around him immediately. Right. There's this kind of like unease that he has with that kind of position because people will read certain things into what he says that he maybe didn't intend, but just because of who he is. Right. And it also like, it strikes me that the green and the white, he doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about it in this chapter, maybe none at all. And it's interesting the way you put it, cause it is this conceptual thing that allows him to make a lot of sense of things. But what's interesting about the way that that's presented is that it's never presented in a way that lets us make sense about things the way that it makes sense to him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it's never explained to us, the reader, what the green and the white really actually mean. It's always left in this vague thing, which gives Nergal a kind of, you know, it's almost like a screen that allows us to project a little bit what we, maybe not, I don't know, maybe we're not projecting onto him. I mean, he's projecting a lot all over to everybody, right? Yeah. His anxiety about Hiroko and his patrilineal, you know, his lineage or whatever, he's projecting that all over the place and he doesn't realize it. I don't know that we're projecting a lot onto him and his solution for the green and the white, but it just sits there as a kind of placeholder that remains vague to us as well, and maybe sort of mirrors a kind of vagueness that Nergal feels himself.
Yeah.
Like it stands, it's a figure that stands in for understanding for Nergal, like a screen memory that doesn't actually have any explanatory power. It only has the appearance of explanatory power.
I mean, I think it has a little... I mean, to me, it has some explanatory power because it's about a way of figuring what it means to encounter and resolve contradictions, and in particular, like, the contradiction between, like, the abstract and the material or something like that. But I agree that, you know, what, I mean, to me, like, what one of the things that we see in this chapter and part of the sort of, like, struggle of Nergal, I mean, isn't it Coyote... Either Coyote or Sax is the one who says to him, and it's funny that you could possibly mix up a thing that Coyote said or the thing that Sax said. But one of them is like, I remember when you were a child and you, it must be Coyote who says, when you were a child and you were sitting with Sax and he came back to life.
Yeah.
And what does he say? Are you on that page?
He says, so on 392, this is a really amazing scene, I think. It's just so incredible.
I love Coyote sleeping on the park.
It's really incredible. My boy, he said at last dreamily, the whole city was quiet. Coyote muttered as if falling asleep. What does the hero do when the tale is over? Swim over the waterfall, drift out on the tide. What? Coyote opened his eyes fully, leaned toward Nergal. Do you remember when we brought Sax into Tharsis Tholis and you sat with him and afterward they said you brought him back to life? That kind of thing. Think about that. He shook his head, leaned back on the bench. It's not right. It's just a story. Why worry about that story when it's not yours anyway? What you're doing right now is better. You can walk away from that kind of story. Sit in a park at night like any ordinary person. Go anywhere you please. Nergal nodded, uncertain. What I like to do, Coyote said sleepily, is go to a sidewalk cafe and toss down some kava and watch all the faces. Go for a walk around the streets and look at people's faces. I like to look at women's faces. So beautiful. And some of them so something. I don't know. I love them. He was falling asleep again. You'll find your way to live.
I think, yeah, this is great. And it's great partly because, like, Coyote is both, like, you know... He's like the mythical wanderer, but he's also like the person who can just like be in a city and like nobody notices him. Right.
He's a homeless man on a park bench.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And like, you know, but also like this, like, you know, he takes up like this flaneur position, right? Yeah. He has so many different possibilities and we know that like that is, you know, that actually he has like been really deliberate about like making that what his life is.
Yeah.
But I think that part about the kind of, you know, Nergal has been forced into being the hero is basically what he's saying. Like, what does the hero do at the end of the story, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like, and then he says, it's not your story. So what I was thinking about, and I mean, and I feel like this is the same thought as you saying, like, we have this possibility of projecting a lot of stuff onto Nergal, is also Nergal is a figure of, like, the problem of the person who seems special, mm-hmm. right? Because we don't, you know, we don't know even now, like, our qualities of Nergal's, like, his kind of the form of intuitive intelligence that he has, that metabolic regulation that he does, all of those things, like, are those characteristic of, like, the ectogenes? Mm-hmm. Are they characteristic of, like, you know, is he sort of characteristic of, you know, his generation on Mars? Or are there other people who have those kind of capacities that exceed sort of versions of, like, just baseline human capacities? You know, or maybe those are just Nergal. They could just be Nergal's qualities, right? So he's always been sort of constituted as special, right? Mm-hmm. And that the story about him,
right,
you know, sitting next to Simon,
right, and bringing him back to life, right?
The story about bringing Sax back to life, right? I mean, like, you know, he's not just the hero, right? He's like the boy hero,
right?
The healer, which is a very particular kind of magic, you mm-hmm. know.
And he needs to make sense of that story,
and right, exactly. And so there's a way in which, like, you know,
he needs to make that story either meaningful and true or, like, false or something, right? Like, he needs to have some status, he needs to have some firm standing in relation to the story that is the story of his life that he was sort of in some way given that he never had a choice in picking.
Right, right. And that kind of, like, so if he's going to be, like, you know, the questing knight, you know, or, you know, heading all over Mars to, like, figure things out or whatever, like, the problem is, so he's supposed to serve this, like, dual function, and the function is that he is both supposed to be special and supposed to be representative.
Right, right, right.
Right, right. And that, like, you know, and that's both, like, that's, like, a political problem. Like, it's a political problem to, like, think that that's what you need, right? But it's also just, like, a huge problem for him because he comes back to Mars having been away and having survived something that, like, you know, he says, or we learn at some point, that going to Earth is basically the riskiest thing that Martians yes. can do, which is an amazing line, right? So he's actually, like, there was nothing weird about him getting sick. Like, and it's actually more sort of impressive that he didn't
that he
die,
survived,
right,
yeah.
from that illness. But he comes back to Mars and he doesn't feel native, but he also doesn't feel special anymore.
Right.
I mean, so, like, you know.
Because he's been confronted with his own mortality. Anyway, yeah, sorry.
Yeah. I mean, and, like, just, like, you know, the world is open to him in this different way. And so there's a weird way. And to me, I was thinking, like, there's a way in which, like, this chapter feels a lot like Michel in Provence, mm-hmm. right? In which, like, mm-hmm. you know, part of what he can't grapple with is, like, it's not the same place and it was never going to be the same place, mm-hmm. but he can't return to it as a different place that is also a place that he has some kind of belonging to, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and, you know, we also, like, Nergal also makes himself a little stone house, like that, you know, tumble down farmhouse,
we'll get to it. Oh, believe me.
I mean, that part is awesome.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think that it's just this interesting, like, in these books, right? You know, one of the things I think that these novels resist, and we've talked about this before, but they resist the production of the hero too.
Yes.
And part of how that happens here is by forcing us to think about, like, how much, like, the idea of the hero depends on that person being constituted as special.
Right.
And then, like, if they are special, like, well, their problem, they have a relationship to the world in which, you know, that's always going to be in some kind of contest.
Yes.
And they either have to, like, overcome the circumstances of the actual world around them or somehow embody those circumstances, right? And, like, you know, I mean, Nergal's solution to this is just to, like, learn how to fly one of these, like, cool little dirigible things and go, like, soaring around the most amazing mesa, one of the craziest settings.
The landscape description here was really breathtaking for me. This is, like, the real, this was really awesome. I wanted to say one more thing about the green and the white
as
a concept, right? So there's this, it provides him this conceptual synthesis, right, that, And like, sort of going back to the kind of way that it makes sense for him, but it doesn't make sense for us, which maybe tells us that it really doesn't make sense for him, but it makes a certain kind of sense for him. Mm-hmm. It allows him to make a certain kind of sense of the world. So that's good, right? Good. You have a concept there that makes sense to you. But then the big problem, and I think this kind of mirrors what you're saying in a different way, the problem is how to make that concept of the world material.
Yeah.
Like how to live it, right? And that's Coyote's last line is like, you'll find your way to live, right? He's found his concept, what the green and the white is. But what does that mean in material reality? You still have to live your life as like a finite human being with like, you know, skin and hair.
Right. Well, and right. And if you feel rootless, is it better to drift or is it better to like plant things?
Yeah. Exactly. And like, yeah, you've said before that we started recording about the way, or maybe you didn't, but maybe it's just in the book, the way that he drifts for like a long time over the surface of of Mars and just kind of like a dandelion spore. I think it does mention that, right?
Yeah.
Just like a dandelion spore floating over Mars, which is what a dream that would be. Like, I love just thinking and imagining about just doing this in this like lightweight jet that's impossible to crash.
It's so beautiful. And then that, what is the mesa called? Like, Charming Mesa?
Candor Mesa.
Candor Mesa.
Sparkling Mesa.
I don't know. I mean, just that like that scene, which ultimately he's like, it's not scaled to what he needs, right? He's like, well, this is not the place that I can stay.
Right.
But it is this like just like glorious, glorious kind of like vision of a Mars that's pretty close to the Mars, at least the Mars that John Boone drove around, right? As we learned specifically.
Well, it's Candor Mesa. I think it's also called Sparkling Mesa or something, but it's also a tourist destination.
Shining Mesa.
Okay. Shining Mesa. Yeah. The description, we could just read it all day long because it's so great. The hang gliders and these blimp gliders. What else was I looking for here? Yeah. Do you have a spot that you want to point out, or?
I don't know if I can find. Sorry, the cat is.
The cat has its butt pointed at the microphone.
It's Violet. This is Violet.
Violet has its butt pointed at the microphone. So Hillary is boxed out.
Yeah, totally boxed out. Yeah. No, I don't have a spot.
Well, on 357, another thing I like about this chapter is many of the subsections start like one day. It's just one day this happened, you know, and I really like that because it just speaks the kind of passage of time and the kind of way that we're in sort of a little bit of fairy tale time here, you know, one day this happened, you know, that there's a routine that's broken up by special things. One day, walking the city wall, looking out through the tenting, he watched a group of people standing on a launch pad at the edge of the cliff west of town. There were a number of different kinds of single flyer craft, gliders and ultralights that were shot out of a slingshot launcher and rose inside the thermals that formed in the mornings. Oh boy. Smaller hang gliders, and then a variety of new one-person aircraft, which looked like small gliders connected to the undersides of small blimps. These flyers were only a bit longer than the people who climbed into the slings or seats under the gliders' wings. Clearly, they were made of ultralight materials. Some were transparent and nearly invisible, so that once in the sky, it appeared that prone or seated people were floating around on their own. Other machines had been colored and were visible from kilometers away as strokes of green or blue in the air. The stubby wings had small ultralight jets attached to them so that the pilots had control of direction and altitude. They were like planes in that respect, but with the added loft of a blimp to make them safer and more versatile. Their pilots landed them almost anywhere, and it looked impossible to dive them, to crash, in other words. So you can just go up and like float all you want.
It's pretty cool. The line that I was thinking of when he's still at Shining Mesa, and he's been thinking really explicitly. Actually, I guess we should read on 370, because here's a place where actually he thinks about the green and the white, right? So 369, Nergal is day after day, Nergal followed this routine, exploring the various regions of the canyons below, watching the exuberant nightlife in the tent, but seeing everything as if through the wrong end of a telescope. Mm-hmm. A telescope consisting of the question, is this the life I want to lead? Yeah, that's a great line. I love that. This distancing and somehow miniaturizing question kept returning to him. That's, again, like so interesting. Spurring him by day as he banked in the sunlight, haunting him at night. What was he to do? The success of the revolution had left him without a task.
Yeah.
Though, of course, there's tons to be done, right? All his life, he had wandered about Mars, talking to people about a free Mars, about inhabitation rather than colonization, about becoming indigenous to the land. Now that task was ended. The land was theirs to live on as they chose. But in this new situation, he found he did not know his part. And then on 370, he thinks about... he flew around the immensities of Kandor looking for some image of himself. Just amazing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you're on this like gigantic mesa flying over this canyon.
Where
right?
am I? Who am I?
The fractured, layered, scarred canyon walls were so many stupendous mineral mirrors. And indeed, he saw clearly he was a tiny creature, smaller than a gnat in a cathedral. Flying around studying each great palimpsest of facets, he scried two very strong impulses in himself, distinct and mutually exclusive, yet enfolded, like the green and the white. On the one hand, he wanted to stay a wanderer, to fly and walk and sail all over the world, a nomad forever, wandering ceaselessly until he knew Mars better than anyone else. So this is also a question about how do you know Mars, right? Yes, it was a familiar euphoria. On the other hand, it was familiar. He had done that all his life. It would be the form of his previous life without the content, and he knew already the loneliness of that life, the rootlessness that made him feel so detached, that gave him this wrong end of the telescope vision. Coming from everywhere, he came from nowhere, he had no home. So he thinks about wanting to settle. And I just, this just for like the sheer beauty of it. So after he's decided he's going to leave, and he thinks like, he's, no, I want to live in the open air. I want to learn a patch of land. And then on 371, no, that was not the kind of home he had in mind. Although he loved the way dawn flushed the fluted west walls of Kandor, flaring all across the Martian spectrum, the sky turning indigo or mauve or a startling earthly cerulean, a beautiful place, so beautiful that on some days as he flew about, he felt it would be worth it to stand on shining mesa and hold his ground to try and preserve it, to swoop down and learn the gnarly wilderness floor, float back up every afternoon to dinner. It just like that description of the light on the wall, canyon walls is so...
Mm-hmm.
So satisfying. No, but,
it's beautiful. It's so amazing. And then that all kind of provokes him into going into John Boone's AI.
Yeah.
And we get, you know, From Beyond the Grave.
Nice to hear the John voice again.
The John voice, just comparing it to Yosemite, you know, where is it? That's about six or seven times as tall as the cliffs of Yosemite. Shit. They don't look that much taller, to tell the truth. Foreshortening, no doubt, right? But yeah, just this... yeah, this rootlessness, this trying to, where do I belong? And like, how can I have both at the same time
type
of thing? It reminded me, actually, I was recommending to you last week, Bruno Latour's newish book, Down to Earth.
Mm.
And that passage you read on page 370 reminded me of kind of his thesis there, which is like there's two kind of poles of modernity or modernization, one moving away from the local and toward the global. And the global that we've been moving toward is proven to be the false global or something like globalization minus is what he calls it, the one that's going to like end the world, right? And we need to figure out a new vector, essentially, that's somewhere. It's basically like glocalization in a certain way, but like with his own current 2017-18 you know, spin on the old favorite of how do we anchor ourselves to the land, because that's what we really need to do. We could need to come back down to Earth and fix the planet while also, you know, having a kind of beingness toward the future or something like that.
Right.
And
right.
Like, that's really the trap that Nergal has found himself in as well, in a certain sense.
Right. I mean, and he thinks when he looks at, this is on 379, just like an incidental moment basically, but he thinks when he's looking at the North Sea, right? Where does this begin? Well, anyway, it doesn't really matter where it begins.
just start reading.
The black violet plate of water below was dotted with sailboats, ferries, long barges, all trailing the white V's of their wakes. Nergal floated over them, circling the barge twice to marvel at
bridge.
The sight. Bridge. Twice to marvel at the sight, like nothing he had ever seen on Mars before. Water, the sea, a whole future world,
Future world, yeah.
I mean, so part of his problem is that, like, the Mars that he's on is itself changing, right?
Yeah.
And that's part of the sort of, like, I think that that's part of that insight about why it's, like, hard to feel one's planetariness, that form of connection, because, like, our first way of thinking about that is this idea that what we are organisms and our surround is the environment,
yeah,
as opposed to, you know, we are the environment is us, mm-hmm, right? All of that stuff is together, and it's not just us who are changing or historical or whatever, mm-hmm, or temporal, mm-hmm, right? It's also like the world, mm-hmm, right? The planet, everything that is around us is also like different and in process of becoming and changing, right? Some of that driven by things that we're doing, some of it not driven by things that we're doing. But that, I mean, but that's what's, I think, particularly hard about that sort of idea is, like, it's very hard to put yourself in this space where you can even begin to, like, where you can even begin to imagine, much less actually sort of, like, feel that connectedness that is in fact there, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it goes back, you know, you brought up the Michel chapter, and it's it goes back to the sense of the unheimlich, the uncanny, the unhomely, in a certain sense, that you're home, but you're not home.
Right. Or Michel's constant turn, you know, he wants to be in this place, but what he really wants to be is in the field of his memories,
yeah,
you know, like that's what the olive is, yeah, right?
Right.
Ceaseless
wandering.
But so I will say, like, as particularly since it is February, mm, and when after those deep below 0 days that we had, was that last week?
It was just last week.
God, time. Yeah. Oh my God, I don't even understand it. So anyway, no, we had a big snow cover,
yeah,
right? And then most of that melted away.
Within days.
Within days, which is amazing. And also the park across from my apartment is so disgusting. It's just foul.
Because of mud or like
it's
garbage?
It's like so muddy.
Yeah, super
muddy. But and so it's not really foul, but it's also way too wet.
Yeah.
But when the snow melted off our garden in the front, so we have a fairly big hellebore, which is in some places hellebores are like evergreen, like, you know, in the Pacific Northwest, mm-hmm, they're like evergreen. Here, like, they usually, like, die back, mm-hmm, in the winter, but it's one of the first plants to bloom, mm-hmm, in the spring, and, mm-hmm, they have these very beautiful blooms, but they, like, hang upside down, like, underneath the leaves, so, okay, they're hard to see. It's, like, a shy plant.
Okay.
But anyway, we have this hellebore, and it is still, like, when the snow melted off it, it's still green under,
yeah,
there. Like, it actually, despite that deep, deep cold,
right,
I mean, it helped to have the snow blanket over it. But just because it's, like, you know, overall just not as cold, it was still green. It's going to bloom in, like, a month, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so very, like, for Chicago, that's incredibly early.
Right.
But then on the other side of our front walkway, we have these two plants that are called euphorbia that Susanna and I randomly planted in the fall. We were just like, I think these will fit in this kind of space where we're having trouble fitting something in.
Mm-hmm.
The snow melted off them. They are not only still alive, but they are, like, visibly growing. It's, like, wild. They're, like, deep green.
Yeah.
And, like, one of them looks like it's starting to make flowers.
Yeah.
I mean, anyway, whatever. So all that is to say, like, I love that this chapter, like, turns to, like, this. I mean, obviously, he's not just gardening, but I'd like to think of it as a little bit like gardening.
I mean, it's pretty much, you know, I can't imagine a better sort of dream than just, you know, finding a giant rock and carving a house out of the inside of it, and then just starting to plant an entire, like, impact basin full of, you know, plants, and just do some huge giant scale kind of, like, Japanese gardening or something like that. Like, I'm thinking back to when I was at the Huntington Library back in December. And they have a great sort of Japanese garden area with all these, you know, dwarf bonsai trees and stuff like that,
and just that problem of, like, so any gardening that you do, like, you know, the first he had to learn the land,
yeah,
and, like, that is, like, even when you just, like, have your little, like, you know, your raised vegetable beds and your little pocket, you know, garden, like, it is just something that is, like, it ties you to process.
Yes.
Like you have to learn, you know, you have to learn all of this stuff about like the soil and the light and the water and like where things move and where things don't move.
Yeah. And it just the things that you discover after time. Right. So like he notes like after the, you know, second March or first November or whatever, like here's where the light is then. Yeah. And here's, oh, now the snow melted and then it, you know, new things happened here. And you have to think about that in the future when you're planting it again. And how this is very, you know, going back to like a kind of resonance with the Western too, he's doing some, you know, homesteading basically. And a bunch of people come up from the village of Dingboch, to help him, you know, basically do a barn raising essentially and like share some native plants with him and some regional farming practices and stuff. It's very cool.
Do you have the description of the house marked?
I have, let's see, when they make it, or I think it's, is it on 386?
Yeah, 386. Yeah.
A couple of them experienced in construction. So they went up to the High Cirque on a little caravan and dumped a load of gear on the ridge near the house boulder and stuck around long enough to clear a first little field of stones, walling it with what they cleared. A couple of them experienced in construction helped him to make the first incisions into the ridge boulder. During this noisy drilling, some of the Dingboch locals... Dingboch? Dingboche?
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe it's German? I don't know. Dingboch locals...
I was thinking Tibetan.
Okay. Dingboch locals cut away at the exterior of the rock, carving in Sanskrit letters, Om Mani Padme Hum, as seen on innumerable Mani stones in the Himalayas, and now all over the southern highlands. The locals chipped away the rock between the fat cursive letters so that the letters stood out on raised relief against a rougher, lighter background. As for the boulder house itself, eventually he would have four rooms hacked out of the boulder, with triple-paned windows, solar panels for heat and power, water from a snowmelt pumped up to a tank placed higher on the ridge, and a composting toilet and gray water facility.
That's so great.
Then they were off. Nergal had the basin to himself. Yeah, man, Green New Deal. That's what I'm talking about. Give me a house inside of a rock, dude.
Oh, it's such a great idea. Yeah, I love that. I mean, I suppose it's a, it's funny to think that his childhood house was in a giant bamboo and now he's going to live in a boulder.
Yeah. It's so neat.
So he's really signing on here for immobility. He's not going anywhere as opposed to that bamboo, which is always growing. Right?
a giant bamboo under an ice dome.
Yeah.
On the South Pole.
That's so good. Oh, this is another, just like in terms of like lines that I, loved on 389. So he spread seeds and spores by hand, casting away from bags or growth media dishes latched to his belt, feeling like a figure from Van Gogh or the Old Testament. It was a peculiar sensation of mixed power and helplessness, so great action and fate. He arranged for loads of topsoil to be trucked up and dumped on in some of the little fields, and then he spread it out by hand thinly. He brought in worms from the university farm at Sabaishi. Worms in a bottle, Coyote always called people in cities, observing the writhing mass of moist, naked tubules. Nergal shuddered. He released the worms onto his new little plots. Go, little worm, prosper on the land. He himself, walking around on the sunny mornings after a shower, was no more than moist, linked, naked tubules. Sentient worms, that's what they were, in bottles or on the land.
You bet.
I love that. It's just
fantastic. Man. After the worms, it would be moles and voles, then mice, then snow rabbits, and ermine and marmots. Perhaps then some of the snow cats wandering the moors would drop by. Foxes. The basin was high, but the pressure they were hoping for at this altitude was 400 millibars, with 40% of that oxygen. They were already most of the way there. Flora and fauna coming in, microclimates, integrated microcline management. Figuring out one's locality's connection to the larger region was a big part of the ongoing work of Ecopoesis. It's very neat.
Oh, yeah.
It's cool.
It's just really great to think about it. And how, like, I think partly what's so pleasurable about this is the way in which it's combining him figuring out how to like build a like life-sustaining operation for him and making a natural space. And it's a natural space that both like, you know, bears reference to Earth because it's made up of Earth plants, but yeah. also the patterns of the things that are growing together and the, you know, the ways in which things get there and crop up. And it seems like their seasonality also is like different from mm-hmm. Earth too. And that we're getting to see the soil that in the last chapter we saw Nadia working on growing.
Well, and the way that it's dispersed. So as you said, the plants are it derived from Earth, but the way they disperse is purely Martian.
Yeah.
Right. That they're still figuring out how the wind is blowing and what it's going to mean in terms of how things get dispersed and how things end up where they are, where you didn't plant them in the first place. Right. Jump dispersal, spread dispersal, stream dispersal, all three were common on Mars, right? These great lists of organisms and stuff.
Which again is like another way of thinking about like the organism is not separate from its environment, right? So they are Mars plants, mm-hmm. you know, because they're on Mars and because like their life cycles, their whole ways of life have been changed by being on Mars. Mm-hmm. This on 394 is that passage that I think we talked about earlier where he thinks about becoming native. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's like kind of joking, but also
he's super interesting. Marmots.
At the end of the long winter, the marmots came out of hibernation early, nearly starving. Their internal clocks still set to Earth. Nergal set out food for them in the snow and watched from his house's upper windows as they ate it. They needed help to get through the long winters to spring. They regarded his house as a source of food and warmth, and two marmot families lived in the rocks under it, whistling their warning whistle when anyone approached. Once they warned him of people from the Terena Committee on the Introduction of New Species, asking him for a species list and a rough census. They were beginning to formulate a local, quote, native inhabitant list, which once formed would allow them to make judgments on the subsequent introductions of fast-spreading species. Nergal was happy to join this effort. I love this is just like the work is going on everywhere, mm-hmm. you know. Nergal was happy to join this effort, and apparently so was everyone else doing ecopoiesis on the massive. As a precipitation island hundreds of kilometers from the nearest others, they were developing their own mix of high-altitude fauna and flora, and there was a growing sentiment to regard this mix as, quote, natural to Tyrena. I'm not sure if that's how you say it, to be altered only by consensus. The group from the committee left, and Nergal sat with the house marmots feeling odd. Well, he said to them, now we're indigenous.
Yeah, this is so interesting because it's, now we're going to regard this mix as natural to Tyrena, even though, you know, we're the ones actively planting it, right? Yeah. And it reminded me of like, and this whole kind of passage too, this whole project reminds me of like Michelle's constant searching for the alchemist, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And I think he kind of tries to put the alchemist on Nergal, mm-hmm. right? And in this regard, it is kind of a sense of alchemy that, you know, from a dead planet, you know, I mean, the overall sense from we are bringing life to it. We're putting things on it. And there's a kind of relationship. There's a very Adamic relationship here, right? Like he is like, he has dominion over nature. He communes with the marmots.
Right. Right. Although at the same time, it feels like it's made so clear that not only what he's doing is tied up with all this work that other people are doing in other places, but also that it depends, you know, that like it is a mix of active and completely passive, yeah. right? He has to spend so much time just waiting. You know, that fantasy of having it, of having dominion over it is clearly not one you can dwell in.
Yeah, that's true. Although the waiting is you're waiting in order to increase your dominion over it, basically. I mean, it's still sort of programmatic.
Well, except that your program is always being interrupted because like other things turn out to grow and then you're like, well, okay, like, you know, let me try this or let me try
right,
this.
Right.
And then of course,
adaptation, right.
And of course, like any fantasy of dominion is completely overturned when everything starts dying. And this is the description of like just like seeing things that are yellowed and wilting when they shouldn't be is so
your stomach just
it's
falls.
So horrible. Yeah. yeah.
But before that, we get that Jackie visit where she, you know, and this part is very disturbing to me. I mean, like not disturbing. Well, you know, because she and Antar, they all look super young. Yeah. So it's these just it's young creepy. People yeah. driving around in dune buggies, basically. Yeah. You have to think about Joshua Tree during the during the government shutdown annihilating God. It, right?
Yeah.
But that they're just having such a great time, and they live in this kind of complete fantasy world of like eternal youth, which is very, it's just disturbing to me to think yeah. that, you know, especially the way that it's framed, right? That she looks, she still looks 15 M years old. I just read that as 15 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, oh boy, that's creepy. Like, that's just weird. Okay, so fine, they're 30, right? So, okay, big deal.
Right.
But still, it's like that kind of, that you know, they still look that way. And from Nergal's perspective, they still sort of behave that way, right? That they are... But only from this moment that he's at where he has finally rooted himself. They really appear rootless because they just kind of drive in and drive out and have this kind of lark. And the one moment where she kind of her beauty fades momentarily is because like these people are the people who are coming aren't integrating with the Free
yeah,
Mars program.
Yeah.
And it's funny too, because it's like, just like you said they would. So now we need your help. It's like, well, I told you that. But now it's too late, you know, like, yeah. why didn't you listen to me when I said it in the first place type of thing?
Well, and in some ways that, you know, their youth and their like carefreeness and like having fun or whatever is, it feels like much more just like a performance of yeah. something at this point, right? Or, you know, why are they having a good time? Because they're basically on vacation.
On vacation, yeah.
Right? Because otherwise, like, Jackie is a creature who just has to work all the time,
yeah,
right? I mean,
not...
she's always working.
Yeah.
You know, and that in itself feels like you know, she and Antar would be like much more likable if they were like, you know, just mm-hmm. like driving around and
yeah.
enjoying themselves.
Sure.
I mean, they'd be gross in some other ways, but it's sure. it's more like that sort of like relentless drive
yeah.
Toward power that she has.
And the which he kind of refuses to tell her because she wouldn't understand it anyway. What Nergal shook his head. So you won't come back, she said at last. You don't care. Nergal shook his head. How to say to her that she was not worried about Mars but about her own power? He wasn't the one who could tell her that. She wouldn't believe him, and maybe it was only true to him anyway, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that is actually a moment where he's like closer to seeing that the way that he sees her is so filtered through
right.
their relationship
right.
and his dislike of her.
Right.
Yeah.
But also is, you know, like trying to be on her side a little bit, her version of Mars is the one that she's trying to protect. So she is trying to protect
right,
Mars. It's
right.
just that it's not the Mars that he cares about or that, you know, he's trying to find.
Right. And it's so like this, that bit on 396 that you read where it's just like so naked that, you know, what she's frustrated with is not like the big problem of immigration, which
mm-hmm.
is a big problem. But she's frustrated, and she's not frustrated with how like it's really hard for people to like be uprooted from like as at the beginning their little village in China and be told like, hey, why don't you just like go on up to Mars? It'll be
hey,
just the same.
How about a unanimous vote, gang? all those in favor?
But those are not the things that bother her. Just the thing that bothers her is, oh, they're not joining my party.
Yeah, they don't.
Right?
They don't want to come to my party.
Yeah. Well, they're not going to vote for me.
Yeah, they're not going to vote for
me. Or they're
me,
not
exactly.
increasing our power base. I guess that's more what it is. So yeah, in the wake of their visit is when the virus, which is actually like something like a, what do you call them? A prion? The little folded proteins that cause it's like
they
the same.
They call them virids.
Yeah, they call them virids, but on 399, virids had also been confirmed as the agent. Some animal brain diseases like scrapie, that sounds bad, Kuru, also bad, and Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease in humans, which is mad cow disease, right? And isn't the prion like the... that's what the little protein thing that causes that. Anyway, it's the same kind of idea. But this, I just like, first of all, it's very upsetting. And thinking about, you know, like, you know, you're going to have to change out the soil
yeah.
and trying to do all of these things like that. All of that is so upsetting. And it feels upsetting as like the end of this or, you know, this like threat to this place that Nergal has been building. But it's also so interesting to think like, I mean, this is the first time we've had to consider you know, viruses or other things like viruses arriving on Mars, right?
Yeah.
And think about like these living populations, both of like, you know, plants and animals and humans who might be susceptible to these things in entirely new ways, right? So then Nergal's illness on Earth here, and you know, a version of that might then appear on Mars.
It just comes back to haunt him so much because he's still sort of so shaken up by that. Maybe it's repressed a little bit, but you know, having lived through that, he's so much more sensitive to it, and he's really shaken by all of this. And especially, like, it's so fascinating the way that it's framed. It's not a pathogen, a bacteria, or a virus.
Yeah.
It's an RNA fragment with a molecular weight of about 130,000, while the smallest known viruses had molecular weights of over a million. So it's this tiny, tiny, tiny,
right.
tiny, tiny
right.
thing that they don't even know, you know, sort of exactly how to fight, which is remarkable too, because of all that they've, all that science allows them to do. I mean, we have like longevity treatments, right? But still there's something that will find a way to exploit and to kill.
Well, I mean, this too is Viriditas, right?
Viriditas.
On 400, so Sax is like, well, you can change some grasses, cycle out your potato patch soil. Nergal feels better. He has some wine. He's got a little brandy. I like Nergal. I like that, you know, he's been able to become resilient,
yeah.
right, over the course of the chapter. These things are strange, eh? He said over an after-dinner brandy. What life will come up with? If you call it life, this is a very Sax response. Well, of course. Sax didn't reply. And I mean, and I think that's an interesting, right? Because it is life, right? I mean, this is... I've been looking at the news on the net, Nergal said. There are a lot of infestations I never noticed before. Parasites, viruses. Yes, sometimes I worry about a global plague, something we can't stop. Ka, could that happen? There's all kinds of invasions going on. Population surges, sudden die-offs all over, things in disequilibrium, upsetting balances we didn't even know existed, things we don't understand. As always, this thought made Sax unhappy. Biomes will eventually come into equilibrium, Nergal suggested. I'm not sure there is such a thing. As equilibrium? Yes, it may be a matter of, he waved his hands about like gulls, punctuated equilibrium, without the equilibrium, punctuated change, perpetual change, braided change, sometimes surging change. And then this turns into the conversation they have about emergence and also math. But I mean, part of what's I love about this conversation is, first of all, we have the feeling of like threat, right? Invasions. You know, like you're creating all of these new like ecosystemic relations, and then it's not, you know, like whatever means, you know, might have worked on Earth to control certain kinds of, you know, invasions of parasites or viruses into similar ecosystems may not work the same kind of way on Mars.
Yeah.
But then that goes from this discussion about like that is this kind of threat into this idea of like, you know, the perpetual becoming of like, you know, the living world in a way that I just think is really beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah.
And temporarily reassuring.
Well, that
until the very last,
until
thing
the very last thing.
The
well, I mean, it, you know, it foreshadows it as well because it is perpetual change. Right. I like the idea of equilibrium just being a myth, you know, equilibrium not existing.
Right.
Because that also is a question of scale. Right. Equilibrium is maybe, you know, the exception that proves the rule or something like that, not the norm. Right. That things are always in motion.
Right. Right. Exactly. And the in motion is partly about, you know, sort of like reproduction, but it's also partly about the way in which newness is always coming out of that.
Always
right?
present. Yeah.
New sets of relations, new possibilities.
And then, yes, this giant storm, dust storm that just covers everything, which is very depressing.
A dust storm that covers everything and that is so much worse than dust storms used to be because now they have an atmosphere, right? So the whole, the conditions, their conditions of possibility also become, so you would have gotten like millimeters of dust and
right.
now there are drifts
it's
of
a
dust.
Meter. Yeah, a meter deep. So, yes, all the best laid plans are kind of thrown up and there's nothing that can be done. In the last paragraph, In time, other winds would blow some of this dust away. Snow would fall on the rest of it, and when the snow melted, the resulting mud would run over the spillways, and a new leaf vein system of channels would cut a new fractal pattern, much like the old one. Water would carry the dust and finds a way down the massive and into the world, but by the time that happened, every plant and animal in the basin would be dead. Bummer.
Yeah. And you know, that sort of like that sequence before the dust storm begins with him thinking about the marmots as a worrying species.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But he, Nergal, is feeling a little bit better because he's feeling like, oh, there are things I can do. Mm-hmm. Right. But I just like, it's such a great entanglement of like processes set in motion by human intervention and, you know, totally non-human processes.
Yeah.
And that in the end, like, you know, well, stuff is going to come back to life, right? There will be new life here because a bunch of natural processes will keep going. But everything that Nergal is gone, including the marmots, are dead. I mean, and, you know, obviously I care about the grass too, but, you know.
Well, the marmots, they were so cute. He like really talked, he really bonded with them. They became indigenous together.
I mean, obviously the marmots are in here just to make sure that like we pay attention to what's happened, because if it was, it would be, you know, equally a loss if it was the grasses,
right,
the little trees, mm-hmm, the flocks, the Jacob's ladder, all of the things that he has you know, help to grow there. But, you know, human beings like to have something cute to feel.
You got to have the charismatic megafauna. And if you can't have charismatic megafauna, might as well have some charismatic microfauna. Regular fauna.
Regular fauna.
Medium fauna.
I thought this is such a good chapter.
Yeah, I really liked it a lot.
About, like, entanglement.
Yeah.
And then also like, oh man, just like sad at the end.
It's very sad at the end. But the landscape descriptions and the descriptions of when he's floating over the surface were, to me, that was just like really great stuff.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
Yes. And this is totally a chapter to like activate your like feeling of, you know, if you felt a little bit like Nadia, like, oh my God, Mars is just like politics.
Yeah,
politics,
right.
Your feeling of like the beauty and the extraordinariness and how great it would be to see it.
Yeah. Next chapter is a Sachs chapter. And so it must be about both science and politics in some way.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what it's about. He does mention to Nergal in the chapter that he wants to go talk to Anne about this new, you know, infestation, this infection. So maybe we can look forward to seeing something about that.
Yeah.
But the first beginning of the chapter after the...
What's it called in the next chapter?
The next chapter is called Natural History.
Ah, that's right.
And
good
the
name.
The first line after the prologue includes our good friend Harry Whitebook, who was the designer of the polar bear.
Oh, right. With his muzzle and his claws?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know if he like makes an actual appearance or if it's just a reference to his research and his engineering, but good old Harry Whitebook.
Oh boy, charismatic megafauna.
Tell me about it. Speaking of charismatic megafauna,
yes.
Google gmail.com is our email address.
Oh right, yes,
with
it is.
Marooned on Mars. podcast@gmail.com
Marooned on Mars podcast@gmail.com
It's not a charismatic I was trying to make a good transition, but
it's not a charismatic.
Kind of
none of our online handles are charismatic in any way.
No. @podcastonmars is our Twitter handle.
Mm-hmm.
You can rate and review us, and you should rate and review us on iTunes and all the platforms. And you know, just tell all your friends about it. And what else do we do? There's the Anchor FM app, which you can leave a voicemail on if you ever want to.
Mm-hmm.
And you can buy the Spirit of Spaces album, Extra Extra, at various online locales.
You can listen to it. I don't know if you can
listen
buy
to
it or
it.
Not.
Just listen.
And that's the maker of our theme music.
And the maker of our theme music, which is about to start to play us out.
Uh-huh.
And
is that what happens?
Play us out.
Yeah.
Spirit of Space.
We walk off the stage.
We drop the mic. And then that's it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
Keep reading. Stay warm
or cool, depending on where you are.
Hey, chill out, bro.
We have listeners in Australia, and they, I think, are probably extremely hot.
Oh, yeah. It's summertime down there, and it's also
like
hot.
Super drought.
Is it a big,
horrifying?
Yeah. Sorry, Australia. but hey, we gave you this podcast, so.
Man,
thank
yeah.
you. Oh, we had, yeah. you know, a few people donate to the show, and we should just thank them.
Oh, I know.
We shouldn't.
Where is that money? Does it just like live on Anchor FM?
I could download it into my account and then, you know, hand you a $20 bill or something like that. But yes, it's just sitting. We haven't had a production meeting about where that money goes, but it's just sitting in Anchor's coffers.
They're probably profiting off it.
They probably invested
interest that
$15. Well, as well they should. They've just got to grow their business and that kind of thing. I mean, it's our fault that we haven't downloaded the money.
Anyway, that's really nice.
Very nice of you to donate. You don't have to do that, but you know, keep doing it and get your friends too, so that we can quit our jobs and become podcast moguls.
That's the dream. That's the dream. Live in a boulder and be a podcast mogul.
You know, if you and maybe 5,000 people each gave $1 a month, that would be way more than we would. Well, that'd be a lot. Get 5,000 of your best friends to give us $1 per month, and we can do a lot more of these shows.
That's true.
I could do more. I don't know if you could do any more.
Well, if I quit my job, I could do more.
Well, we'll talk about this off air.
We're not good with figures.
We'll run the numbers.
Or facts.
We'll run the numbers off air. All right.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Liv, for listening. Goodbye.
Bye.